I think the information you need about this weekend might be the world premiere of My Favorite Toy Was Dirt, an American story in concert, written by Patrick F. McManus, music by Olivia Brownlee, starring Tim Barron's versus seven musicians. And Tim, right there, just reading off your circular, we've defined the whole thing, haven't we?
We have. That's thanks, Vern, for the time. Yeah, I'll be going out shoveling now.
Okay, yeah, that is the price of...
All the guests that come here, your public should know, have to shovel in order to get a few
course,
seconds.
Yeah.
There we go. Thanks,
Vern.
Okay,
but anyway, and then the quick overview, and we'll double down on this later. It opens this Friday in Spokane at the Lehrer Auditorium. It moves to Sandpoint on the 22nd and 24th, Friday and Sunday of next weekend at the Panada Theater. Then it returns to the Spokane area on Friday, March 1st at Opportunity Presbyterian Church. We'll repeat that information a little later. But not everybody, as hard as it is to believe, understands the immediate sense of what is McManus, what is Barron's, what is nonsensical titles that allude somehow to growing up in North Idaho. So kind of your elevator speech of how you've spent the last 30 years of your life.
Well, Rancid Crabtree and I have come on a long archipelago. The bond between Pat McManus and myself was set when he was my advisor at Eastern Washington University in the MFA program. And depending on who you believe, I asked him once, I said, did he think his material might make it on the stage? And he said, you know, I've always been thinking about having a stage show. And I asked him to describe what was in his mind. And he said, well, I saw lots of dancing girls, and then there would be some musicians, and then there would be some dancers, you know, men and women dancing. And he described this extravaganza, and then I said, well, how much do you want to put into this as a budget? And when I saw that, I knew we had a one-man show. So this began, the first show was called McManus and Me Tonight. No, I'm sorry, McManus Tonight, because we didn't know whether it would last more than the night or even if it would get through that night. And that was our first performance in 1992, in October. And
1992?
Whatever, it's been 26, 27
okay,
years.
Okay, yeah, that would be 1992.
Don't
yeah,
tax yeah, my brain yeah, at okay, this point with math.
No, it was your enunciation I was wanting.
Okay. So we didn't know whether it would work, and there was huge, he had never seen the show. He hadn't participated in rehearsals or anything because he was on a book tour. He, as a matter of fact, we weren't even sure he'd get there. He was flying in from Atlanta after signing books there. So he did come down into the dressing room. He really trusted Jack Delahanty, our director, who was responsible for so much of the cohesiveness of the show. And he said, you know, Tim, I just want you to know that if you don't get a laugh in the first minute, and it isn't a real good one, I'm taking my entire family and leaving the movie theater, and then I'm going to come back and kill you. So
pressure.
This kind of support was constant throughout our relationship. He often joked at times, which were scary to me, because I was, of course, I'd never done a one-man show. This artistically, it's kind of an interesting animal because first of all, you take the material from the page and they go to the stage. And Pat had never written for the stage before. So Jack and I were able to help clear that up because it is a different form of writing. And then when he got it, he was really good. I mean, McManus in Love was almost entirely written just for the stage with new material, not so much taken from the books, although some stories were. So it was an interesting partnership, I guess you'd say. Burbage and Shakespeare comes to mind. And I thought Pat's material, some critics had poo-pawed it, you know, thinking it was, I don't know.
Shallow,
ragtag. And I didn't, and a lot of critics didn't, who and professors would write to him, dons from New England, from England, and would write to him about how funny it was and how great it was. And so I thought you know, this is worthwhile getting out there to a new audience, the stage audience. And that's what I did. And with his help, I mean, with his words, I developed all of these characters, a voice and a posture. We wanted to keep it as sparse as possible. He believes in the power of the audience imagination, that if you just describe Rancid Crabtree with two sentences and no more, you know, he chewed and spat tobacco, he drank homemade whiskey from quart jars, and he told outrageous lies. Well, right, you don't have to say much more. You just let the audience use their own Rancid.
About how many characters did you encompass?
Over the five shows, it's, if you count the minor characters like the bat, the bear, and the bicycle, it's 31.
Yeah.
But if you just look at the major characters, you know, there's a dozen. And they are the characters that I take with me in the van so that I'm never lonely when I'm touring. Mm-hmm. And they each have a function. Crazy Eddie Muldoon is the energy of all the shows. He's a wonderful character. And it was cool because Pat didn't send me Act 2 for that first show until like a week or 2 weeks before the show. So, and I'm a slow study. I like to really mull over it. And so I was very nervous about that, and so I was always had a little edge on my heart for him because he left me in the lurch there. And then one day he said on a radio interview with me, he told the interviewer that he now tries to write Rancid Crabtree and Crazy Eddie Muldoon and Mrs. Muldoon and all these characters. He says, and I can't get Tim's voice out of my head. I can't write without hearing these characters that way. So I smiled and said, yeah, it's part of getting even.
Yeah. Well, and certainly for those of us who encountered it over the years and saw the development, saw as you got deeper and deeper into those characters and the way you would completely animate those characters, and it's been a fabulous relationship for you with all to take on all those characters, and if, again, if somebody is wondering who's this McManus and what's it about, these are stories based on his childhood in North Idaho and the real salt of the earth basic people that he either was or imagined.
Yes,
yeah.
And who he encountered in one fashion or another.
Yeah.
People often came up to him after the shows and said, well, are those stories real? And he would always hedge his bets, and of course, or perhaps, or...
Yeah, of course.
But they were built on actual real people. I had the pleasure once of meeting the character who became Crazy Eddie Muldoon and things like that. So... at any rate, that relationship ended, of course, last April when Pat passed away.
Sure. And so it was time to look for a new manifestation, right?
Right. Well, I had been working on this for about a year, the idea of taking some music and seeing if we could cradle the stories in a new form that would take it now from the page to the stage to the musical lover,
mm-hmm.
so that we keep expanding a little bit the audience, and see it's not a musical in the sense of a musical comedy, Vern. Mm-hmm. It's more like the music you've been playing this morning, but it's a different animal entirely, and I didn't know what it was going to sound like or be. I know that Olivia Brownlee, the composer, has captured. Mm-hmm. In her themes, all of these characters. As a matter of fact, there's in the overture, which you'll be happy to know we completed last night, in the overture, there we ask in the program for the audience to listen, for those who know McManus, to listen and see if they can recognize the characters.
Lovely, okay.
And
so,
things like that.
So that's... we're hearing from Tim Behrens. Now let's bring in the musician, Olivia Brownlee. Good morning, Olivia.
Good morning.
And we who know you and your many different talents, certainly, we're not allowed to put adjectives, are you? Are because I've heard you do beautiful jazz. I've heard you do other styles. I've heard you. I know that you ran off and played banjo with a the cabaret show did once, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So you have a whole lot of breadth, including parents who have a whole lot of musical breadth that you've grown up in. You've been one of the Andrews sisters, as I remember, and
tribute,
mm-hmm. and thank you. and all of these things. When you got found, when you got approached, were you aware of the McManus shows or any of this, or was this all new to you?
Oh, yes. No, I'd seen Tim perform the show several times, both at the Rock and Bee Ranch when he was working with
course,
my parents
and course, yeah.
during that time period. And also in other places as well. I'd seen the DVDs. Mm. So I was familiar with the stories already. And I think Tim can corroborate this, but I think part of the reason he asked me is because of that breadth that I have. You know, these are really universal stories, but they're rooted in the heart of America.
Mm-hmm. which certainly musical style that you're versed in. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, yeah, we forgot to mention her parents who run the shows at the Rock and Bee Ranch, which is also another side of quintessentially American in that way. So now let's, between the two of you, get into the process of you know, what did you discover? What did you see? When did you say, oh, yeah? When did you say, no, that's not quite it? You know, in putting music to this.
Well, the first thing I did when I asked her politely, we were setting some ground rules, and I asked her, she would come to the initial rehearsals with a baton in hand, and she would sharpen it as we were talking, and that kind of put me off. So, of course, I asked her, I can't be serious about this stuff. It's a very complicated process. It took more than a year, Vern, and it's not easy, what we're trying to do.
No,
and
I understand.
It is strange and...
Let's let Olivia answer for that because you were the one that suddenly you had this blank slate. You had to create music that represented these stories that a lot of people know and love.
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge. It's mm-hmm. and a welcome one because you know my background is in theater, my education background. Mm-hmm. So being able to combine something that I've just done all the time, the music, with something that I have an education, and I was like, well, this seems like a good way to go. But it was, I think I heard, no, that's not going to work, a lot more than, oh, that's it.
But so what would you do? Would you just kind of play a riff for Tim and suggest that was kind of a musical style or a musical feeling that you wanted to put to a certain thing, or what did you do?
Yeah, how I started was I started creating themes for each character. Mm-hmm. For example, Crazy Eddie Muldoon. Or actually, I started with Rancid Crabtree because he lends himself to a lot of wobble and dissonance, and you know, I don't really care what people think of me, and so I began with banjo, and added trombone, and a little bit of rhythmic support from the viola. And presented that in MIDI form and music form to Tim, and Leslie helped him interpret. And he emailed me right away and said, it's almost good. Mm-hmm. It's almost quite there. And this was the process from for Rancid, for Eddie, for Pat, for you know all the characters that appear in this selection of McManus stories. And then finding ways to fit sound effects and foley in between the stories and in the midst of the stories, sometimes in the midst of a theme, you'll have one or two or all the instruments creating a noise rather than a song. Mm-hmm. And that has to be written into the document mm-hmm. that people receive so they know when and where to put it. So that is why I developed the document the way I did. I've been just inserting music right into the script. Because it didn't make sense to try to fit little cue lines above the score. It just wasn't enough. And oftentimes the cue lines change because Tim has a way of adjusting and developing the script according to who's in the audience and where they're laughing and for how long. So everything that I designed musically had to fit into that kind of format because I couldn't ask him to change a show that he'd been doing to suddenly make rigid a show he'd been doing fluidly for 25 years.
Sure. So then how does the texture work when we come see this show on Friday? what percentage of the time is music going on, for instance, give or take?
Music or sound?
Well, sound. Yeah, essentially, it's you have created the soundtrack for the whole the whole event. That there will be some sense of sound continuously
it's
on this.
Basically, a live score. And Tim forced me to watch. What was it? The
Spike Jones?
No. I knew about Spike Jones already. The Western. What was the Western? How the West Was Won. Mm-hmm. He forced me to watch that for the it was really good. I actually loved it. For the score, because
Ennio Marconi,
like, Ennio. I want you to listen to the silence in this musical score. And I said, all right. And so I wrote silence into specific parts of our scorped. And then we performed it for the first time with the musicians, and Tim said, "Too much music."
Well, Ira Glass has talked a lot about that, about the effectiveness of when the music stops. Mm-hmm. That's a powerful dramatic moment for you to be able to use, and so I can imagine that. You have your harmonica in your hand. Are there close by? Are there? Can you play a riff or two that represents something that, you know, an idea, a musical idea you might have used?
And the harmonica is a special instrument for two reasons. One, it only appears for one character, and I'll let you guys guess which character it is, both you, Vern, and the people listening at home.
Okay.
And the other reason that it is a special instrument is because it is probably really far from my first. So here we go. This is Olivia Brownlee on the harmonica, live for the first time.
I can't cast the character, but I can enjoy the innocence that you communicated.
Thank you.
With that little line. So now I have to give up, or are we gonna? I'm guessing the character.
Mostly, the innocence you were interpreting was my sheer terror.
Yeah.
No, that appears at the end when the entire orchestra, all seven of us, gather around the campfire with Pat and Old Ed.
Oh.
So.
Old Ed,
Who's
contemplating mortality in his own way.
Yeah.
A fine and pleasant mortality, if you will.
So then...
There is an actual plot to this.
You say there is?
Yes, because what I wanted to do to honor Pat and to... I took stories from the previous shows, from all five shows, and created at the beginning. I wanted to do birth and the beginning of life, and then as a youngster, years 6 through 9, and then teenager, and then learning to go camping, and then hunting, and then finding out that your fear of the dark when you're young is nothing compared to your fear of girls. So there was the first date, and then finally at the end there's the contemplation that we all face of mortality.
Wow.
But so there
a life cycle. There
was an exercise Gene Engany made us do in studying. Both Olivia and I studied with
made
Gene
us do.
On
oh,
you stage
did? Okay.
His exercise he would do, which is said we would have to travel from one side of the stage to the other side of the stage and encapsulate a life.
In 50 minutes.
And so you start stage left and you move and you are born and how you develop. And so it's kind of based on that concept, which is a theatrical concept
I still think about that exercise.
Yeah, of course you would. And let me inject in here. If you're just joining us, my favorite toy was Dirt is the title of this show, An American Story in Concert. And so it's this combination of the Patrick McManus words and Tim Barron's delivery that we've grown to know and love for a quarter century. And now with the addition of seven musicians and the score created by Olivia Brownlee that opens this Friday, 7:30 at the Lair Auditorium in Spokane, and tickets are through Brown Paper Tickets.
And at the door.
and at the door, of course, at the door, and it returns to the area at Opportunity Presbyterian Church on Friday, March 1st, in between two performances, appropriately enough, in Sandpoint, because that's actually where the genesis of the whole thing with Patrick McManus, and so that's Friday and Sunday, February 22nd and 24th, on that. So talk a little, Olivia, about the orchestra, the seven pieces. You needed seven really versatile, amazing players, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Not just versatile and amazing, but also really attentive. Mm-hmm. And that's the other reason that I developed the document, the scorped, the way that I did, mm-hmm. because I wanted it to be easily internalizable. Because I said before I hired any of them, I said, it's going to be essential that you do not have your nose in the book for this performance. Mm-hmm. You absolutely have to be watching the actor, maybe 50% of the time, the conductor 50% of the time, and the rest of the musicians in the band 50% of the time. So being a musician didn't make me any better at math, but it did make me a very good listener.
Yeah.
And especially since this score is designed to be very fluid around how Tim performs the show, I needed musicians who I could count on to be that attentive.
And so to get your sound, what's the range of instruments you're using?
Well, I used to live with a violist, so from Bonner's Ferry, actually. And so I wanted a viola. And I knew I wanted a trombone because they are as funny looking as they are funny sounding. Mm-hmm. Same with the banjo. And a trumpet, of course, because they're, you know, it's all America. You have to have somebody who can play tattoo or taps. And a honky-tonk piano. So I called all of the theaters and said, please don't tune your piano too much before the show. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have a percussionist and Foley artist.
A viola?
That was the first one.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds like an amazing thing to do to write something precise and yet fluid at the same time. Whew. And as you say, Tim, it's you're kind of really looking for a new art form or creating a new art form in some many ways, or at least an untrodden path, it would seem.
Well, that's our job as artists and musicians and actors and players like you, Vern. You do the same thing. I mean, it's to try and make our life to keep going in. You know, this may not be a success. We have no idea where this mm-hmm. is going, and nor do we. We're doing four performances because four performances, you get a sense of what works, what doesn't. You know, what it might be that we just stop at that point. It might be that we continue to go on. It all depends on what comes of this, and that's the way it is in the arts. Mm-hmm. The best we can do is hold true to taking the radiance that we find within ourselves and sharing it with an audience and making them laugh long, deep, and wholeheartedly. That's our goal. And then after, we'll see. You know, it's always got to be in the art. Arts don't develop quickly. Well, that's not true. Mozart
except when they do.
Had a skill.
Yeah. And is there an overall website people can remember if they've
McManusPlays.com.
So that would be the most important single piece of information I could give you. McManusPlays.com. McManus is just McManus, plays.com. And then you can get all the rest of these details that you're not going to quite hear because the dog's going to bark when I tell you the date. That's how it always is with radio. But anyway, the essential thing, it opens this Friday at the Spokane Community College Lair Auditorium. That's the same place the Fall Folk Festival happens. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to Sandpoint the following weekend for two performances and then comes back to Spokane Valley on March 1st. So that's the overview of it. Well, it's been fascinating hearing about this project over the last few months. And I'm looking forward to seeing it in three and hearing it in three dimensions.
You and us both.
And thank you for your support, and that's why we did give you a small gift.
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. And, you can close by talking about dirt.
Well, since Pat used to say, it was, you know, my favorite toy was dirt when I was growing up because I couldn't afford anything else. So we came up with this idea for the Kickstarter program, those people who gave a certain level of our Kickstarter, which actually succeeded, our Kickstarter program, mm-hmm. would get a jar of dirt from Pat's fictional hometown of Blight, Idaho. So this is it's a real jar of dirt, but it's from a fictional place.
Will we be able to buy one if we want at the show?
No, we have to work with other forces about that.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
This was available only on a deal for the
contributors.
But I think it's kind of nice, and maybe eventually we'll get to the point where we can offer that.
Great. Okay, my favorite toy was dirt, opening this Friday. Thank you, Olivia Brownlee.
My pleasure.
And Tim Behrens.
Thank you, Vern, for having us.